Okay, good morning everybody. Welcome to another new Energy Chinwag with myself, John Massey, and Charlie Rutten. Morning, Charlie.
Yeah, good day everybody. Good day, John.
Okay, so today we thought we'd cover something that's probably a bit general. We'll see where we go with it, as usual. We've no script to follow or no notes that we're planning on. But there's quite a big announcement here in the UK, for example, last week, what was called the Industrial Decarbonisation Strategy, which covered a whole strand of things. But one chunk of that was the idea of industrial clusters, and in particular, allocating a bunch of money to some industrial clusters here in the UK. So, and clusters have come up quite a bit. Industrial emissions comes up quite a bit, but the idea of focusing efforts on clusters has come up. Industrial strategy increasingly comes up in different countries. So we thought we'd kind of delve into that, see where it takes us. Charlie, do you want to comment a little bit on, we can look specifically at what happened here in the UK, and then we can maybe expand out into what we've seen elsewhere as well. Yeah. You want to kick off with the UK?
I suppose from a development point of view, certainly in our sector, John, there's been a lot of talk, hasn't there, in the last few years about hydrogen and offshore wind and clustering. But I suppose the difference this time, and where it might be a further interest, is actually there's a bit of commitment. commitment, euphemistically, equates to cash on the on the table. And there do seem to have been some quite substantial offers of cash. Certainly here in the northwest of England, we've talked previously about a HyNet, part of the High Deploy programme. And if you think, in the UK, we started off perhaps at Keele University with a safety case, and it's moved on. Hydrogen. There's now Winlayton up in Gateshead, where there's real local infrastructure being put in to test, see how it works with existing appliances on a basis. But the next step, perhaps on the High Deploy program, is to try a cluster or a region. And discussed why clustering is effective in previous podcasts, but we've learned, I suppose, from offshore wind, that if you group together companies in offshore wind, it might be blades and vessels and technical support. And perhaps you could do something similar in the hydrogen sector, in the carbon capture and storage sector. And one aspect of the northwest of England is it's a very old industrial region. What I think is the home of the Industrial Revolution. And even in North Cheshire, Liverpool, Manchester, Ellesmere Port area, you've got a real collection of manufacturing industries. Trafford Park isn't so far. Chemical industries, ports, and of course refineries. So refineries always tend to be part of the cluster. But I suppose the interesting fact on this one is that I think it was awarded over £70 million. And that is more than... It's certainly well more than you need for a desktop studies. It's you're almost into real serious front-end engineering and design possibly work and some serious spend on pushing the cluster forward. So that's what attracted my interest, in that it's not just talk anymore, or it's not just £50,000 here or £50,000 there for another study. It's more tangible than that. And I suppose £70 million, many other clusters would be quite envious of that and think, oh, we could have done with that. And that is a real sign of commitment, not just to the concept carbon capture and storage and hydrogen, but also to the northwest of England and to the regions in the UK as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall, it was something like, was it 174 million quid or something across? I can't remember how many clusters it is, seven or nine or something. There's basically the northwest one, South Wales, couple over on the east coast, one in Scotland, Grangemouth, one down in Southampton, I think. So, yeah, it was interesting. I mean, a few things. I guess the first thing is kind of maybe to delve into kind of why clusters. There was one stat which I've not managed to pull up while we were talking, but it was Teesside. It was some enormous chunk of total emissions in the UK. It was like 12% or something off the top of my head. That might be wrong, but it was a significant chunk, and it was somewhere where there was the five of the top 15 emitters in the UK were all based in that region. So it makes kind of sense from a, if you're going to look at you trying to meet your target, your decarbonisation target, it obviously it's kind of fits in with this idea of, well, starting in the places where the biggest emissions occur, and those aren't kind of evenly spread around countries, not just in the UK, but the same will be everywhere. They tend to be concentrated in particular locations, and those locations tend to be these industrial clusters. So it makes sense from an emissions point of view, I think, to concentrate on clusters. And as we've discussed, it makes sense from a kind of economic and a deployment point of view to focus your efforts and focus your new infrastructure and so on in kind of geographically constrained regions. So if you are going to build new bits of network, be it for carbon capture, be it for hydrogen, be it for expanding the grid or whatever, it's going to make sense to do it over short distances in smaller areas than try and instantly go for some big kind of national plan. So yeah, it was interesting that it kind of was putting that, and as you say, it was putting it into some significant money, because I mean, I think over the last few years there's been lots of kind of desktop feasibility studies, as you say. We've probably got copies of them floating around, read or unread, in our folders. But yeah, to go further, you need more money to do the proper engineering design studies. So yeah, it was interesting. And also it was interesting because it's very much kind of integrating things. So those grants weren't just for hydrogen, they weren't just for carbon capture, they weren't just for other bits and pieces. They were kind of, it was integrating it together. It's kind of the idea that it's not one or the other, it's multiple things happening at the same time. And to kickstart that, to make the case for that, you've got to actually have a strategy, and you've actually got to put some money into making that move. I mean, I noticed, if I was to dig out the press release and read through it again from what I remember reading it originally, carbon capture certainly was the thing that the word that popped up the most, I would say, here in the UK at least. In terms of progressing that, do you see, how quickly do you see that
progressing? Yeah, I think you've hit upon a very interesting point there. And I suppose what you would do is you would assess what you've already got. And not all clusters are the same. So the Teesside one might be different and is different from the HyNet, the Northwestern one. But I suppose to come back to the carbon capture thing, I think you might want to look at the decommissioning timetables of certain assets off sea. For example, in the Irish Sea, I did notice that BP won one of the major leasing rounds in the Irish Sea. So that means that they're starting to look and they gather the data, what is offshore, all the bathymetry. But they might also want to look at some of the existing reservoir capabilities, when the decommissioning timetables are, and what's happening on the pipeline side. Now, you might say, well, some of the pipelines are already in situ. They might already come to shore. If so, where? Could they form part of these studies that you mentioned? It's more than the studies now. It's not just a case of desktoping. So you've got some funds to play with. So you might start to say, well, I think carbon capture and storage requires an awful lot of reservoir space and pipeline capacity. And then you might want to say, well, actually, is there also a place for hydrogen in there? And if so, how? Is that another pipeline? Is that in a different reservoir? Or in Cheshire's case, and indeed Teesside, I think there's quite large salt caverns. Now, I've come across salt caverns in a previous life. I think the idea was then they were going to be methane caverns. The idea was that you might create some kind of liquid, some kind of slurry. You would squirt, sounds very untechnical, but you squirt the slurry around the walls of this cavern and seal it. And that would be a giant seasonal store for methane. It was a hot topic at the time. I think Mr. Putin had put some finger on some pipeline somewhere, and everybody panicked in the energy world, and everybody was going up to these salt caverns. And I think one was built out somewhere. It went massively over budget, as many of these major projects do, and everybody recoiled, and the problem went away. But some of these have been dusted off to an extent and repurposed with this bright new shiny word hydrogen. On the top, slightly different characteristics, different molecular structure and different, but nevertheless, perhaps they could still use the same principles. So I think it's interesting that you mentioned Teesside, which already produces a lot of hydrogen, already produces a lot of emissions, and has these salt caverns, which might work for some kind of long-term storage facility. And then in the northwest of England, likewise, a lot of salt, mile upon mile of salt caverns under Cheshire, which might make, you might make an argument for a repurposing argument or a circular argument. And that is even more the case offshore. And I think the timetables for some of the decommissioning of the fields, I think the feeling is if you've got a relatively recent gas pipeline from the 90s and beyond, you can repurpose it quite trivially in engineering terms for something. And then you might look at the timeline and say, well, when is this reservoir expended? When's it going to finish? And I think if you look around the clusters, not all of them the same, but on the east of England, you might find some favourable timelines and saying, well, this reservoir is going to be ready for use within such and such a timeline, which might fit your local aspirations. And in Teesside, where you've already got hydrogen production, and indeed on close to the HyNet cluster, it's already a known thing. And then I'm usually looking for another part of the equation. I did notice when I was within the Shell world, we used to support Stanlow, which was part of Shell. It's now been divested. But Stanlow was pivoted, and they're talking about sustainable aviation fuel development as well. So that part of the bigger cluster involves a decarbonisation of oil and gas, not just assets offshore, but refineries onshore as well. And if you put those elements together, I think you've almost got a core of what might constitute a typical cluster, if you like. And they're not just in the UK now. They're springing up everywhere. In fact, there's a bit of a reverse beauty parade. Even my hometown of Derby has got a local cluster aspirations. And I think there's stuff Manchester with AIMA, who we've talked with previously, was development in the Manchester, separate from HyNet, but attached to it as well. And then you're starting to get other quirks, such as spurs possibly occurring on pipeline networks. Could Trafford Park, one of Europe's first industrial park, could that have its own hydrogen supply via a spur from the main HyNet cluster? So it's going from the talk, from the desktoping, to some interesting first stage, possibly feed analysis, and then to look, if we are to put a cluster, what's already there? What can we repurpose? What bits should we do first? What constitutes the low-hanging fruit, if you like? And then align that with the oft-forgotten decommissioning costs that some of the oil and gas companies are on the hook for, and perhaps can avoid if they were to reuse their assets for the sustainable future.
Yeah, no, there's a few things there. I mean, for building new infrastructure, it's going to be more economic if you've got lots of customers attached to it. So clusters make a lot of sense there. A few things leap out, I think, from clusters. As you say, not just here, there's clusters, obviously, the Northern Netherlands, Northern Germany. They're talking about them. Australia has a big kind of hub cluster approach to its hydrogen strategy, was very much looking at that. And I think one thing that crops up again and again is being by the seaside, not necessarily the nice, shiny beach seaside, but being on the coast. A lot of these are around ports. A lot of these are around coastal areas. And again, I think good reasons for that are that these clusters also are places where you're importing raw materials and then you're exporting kind of value add materials that you produce. So there's a kind of, they're naturally around ports anyway. So that's, I think that's one aspect to it. And so, and certain countries, I mean, the UK, I think a lot of the announcements around the clusters here are less to do with kind of necessarily export opportunities, but certainly if you're in Australia, a lot of their hub cluster activity is really looking at exports to Asia. So very much around port facilities and coastlines for that reason. Natural resources, obviously, both you mentioned storage, but and the other reason to be around clusters on coastlines is generally, as you say, oil and gas fields, oil and gas resources, but increasingly also kind of renewable resources, offshore wind tied in with quite a number of these different clusters. Obviously not the same everywhere. In Australia, solar, wind, onshore, tied in with those clusters as well. So, yeah, it's bringing together a whole bunch of different. It's having the low carbon resources available. It's having, if you're going to capture carbon somewhere, to stuff it underground, which often is going to be declining oil and gas fields. I mean, it also, I think there's a good point in there about whether they are declining or not. If you're in somewhere where you've got a big industrial hub, but you've got oil and gas fields which are not declining, that's not going to be the same dynamic. So that makes it a more interesting challenge. In some ways, it's kind of easier here in the UK because it's sort of reversing oil and gas fields that have been producing, now reversing them. So they've made money taking carbon out of the ground. They're now looking at making money stuffing it back in again, which may not make.
It's quite a good wheeze. That one, happy, yeah.
There we go. So yeah, whereas other regions, as you say, each region will be different, each cluster will be different. The kind of dynamics of what resources you have, what assets already exist that can be repurposed versus those that can't, what type of industry it is, because that will affect things like carbon capture feasibility. So yeah, there's a whole number of things that come up, but certainly locations, it's noticeable how much of this is kind of coastal port related, yeah, as well.
Yeah, I think you're dead right. I mean, ports want to expand and repivot like everybody else. And if you were to look at the storage facilities, and of course the marine sector as well is looking to decarbonize with bunkering and so forth. And all of that will need infrastructure. Everybody forgets perhaps it's all right to come up with these fancy new vessels, but what about the rudimentaries? Where's the storage for it? How's that? Are you going to repurpose that facility over there? Are you going to need new land for it? I think there are nuances. Not all clusters are the same. I think I look at the Teesside one. It's got a bit of a tongue twister name, but there seems to be some kind of multimodal transport aspiration to it, which is fabulous. But what does that mean? Well, that might mean buses and trains and HGVs and all kinds of things. It might be part also of a national network. The Northwest one, and I'm sure that these will be blue in the first instance and then perhaps becoming green as some of the offshore. You were right to bring in the offshore element. I know at Tees, I'm not quite sure what it is. It says a new port has been announced on Teesside. I'm not quite sure about the details as to where that is yet. Mm. It was in a recent announcement, so that ties in. And of course, Merseyside, Liverpool, Birkenhead, and elsewhere, already large-scale existing ports. The other thing that did strike me as interesting behind it is the engagement of grid. There are two grids, I suppose, gas grid and electricity, which you might argue are actually going to become much closer going in coming years, especially if large-scale electrolyzers are starting to appear. But I suppose the point I'm coming to is that they did announce that their aspiration for a 2,000-kilometre, presumably, hydrogen pipeline backbone. Presumably would link the key hubs. And I think there was talk of going from Grangemouth and perhaps St Fergus up in Scotland, right down to Teesside, and then across to my northwest region, and right down, possibly down to Bacton, and I even caught aspirations of perhaps in Bacton could perhaps be a nice module or node for any European connection. A lot of the facilities are already there. It sounds fanciful, this, but some of the stuff is already in situ. Well, we've got an excellent grid already.
Yeah, that was a national grid announcement, wasn't it? They're basically doing a feasibility study into the potential. My understanding is not looking at building new pipelines, but repurposing some existing transmission network. Basically, the feasibility is to look at how easy it is to do. I had a conversation with someone who's sort of saying, well, how easy is it to do? And my answer was, I don't think they know. That's the people, that's the feasibility study. Unless you do the study, how do you know in the first place? So yeah, but that was certainly, I guess that kind of brings us into the kind of where, well, there's a few things, how we get from, because these things are all very much still, as you say, we've gone from desktop feasibility, now they've got some money to start doing proper front-end engineering design studies. That in itself doesn't mean that therefore it happens. What do you think locally is going to also need to be added from a policy point of view and a market point of view? And then I guess beyond that, I mean, the national grid thing is looking beyond that assuming these clusters do exist in the form that we're talking about, then at what point do you start needing to connect them together? I mean, that's the national grid thing is obviously looking much further forward. I think they're looking towards the end of the decade for something like this actually happening. But in the shorter run, for these clusters to get financial close, how do you see that developing?
Well, yeah, I think it's to hit the nail on the head with the policy stuff, which seems to be lagging. I think the policy might actually exclude hydrogen. Since the natural gas days, they rewrote the rule book, if you like, said we used to have this scary hydrogen that's already in the network. We're going to get rid of that because we've got natural gas and we've had an industry 40, 50 years, very successful one, which might be coming to its end days now. There's some signs that that's coming to a close. It was only supposed to last 10 years, so we've done pretty well to get 40, 50 out of it. But the infrastructure is there, and then perhaps the policy, and I'm sure that the relevant trade organisations are making the voice heard that perhaps the regs need amending. Then there's a safety case behind that, isn't there? There's a lot of work going on at places like Buxton and Spadeadam and in Scotland to make sure that we don't have another Hindenburg, because it doesn't take long in the hydrogen world for that to appear. Mm. But methane has got its own issues as well, and other forms of fuel as well. So I'm sure that that will be resolved. You might then want to look at choosing, I mean, you could always argue that you're given more than seed funding, certainly £70 million is quite a prize, but then you might look to, well, are we just going to choose one cluster to focus on? This is going to be the front runner and use that almost as a lesson learned for a model for the other clusters, or do you just take a hedge on two or three? I think there's a political aspect to this. I mean, there will be an election sooner rather than later, and some of these big infrastructure projects, I mean, some of these will be eye-watering, that 2,000 kilometres of national pipeline backbone won't be cheap. And I feel that argument has been parked to an extent. it's got to be faced at some stage. We're in a pandemic. Every natural instinct seems to have gone out of the window regarding to austerity, which we've had nearly 10 years at least to talk about. So that's got to be addressed. So it would, I don't know the answer to that. You might want to look at low-hanging fruit and saying, well, if we spend another X million pounds or hundreds of million pounds, we can get this, and we're reasonably certain we can get that away, and that will be a big win. You've already mentioned some big wins in the Northeast. So if you put a part of that, and if you did get that big win, then that would serve as a template for others and say, wow, this has worked well. We've created a supply chain. We've got local jobs. We might be an electoral impact as well. I suppose we've got front runners on the clusters, of which you've mentioned some of the areas. And there are others behind that, perhaps slightly slower, perhaps aligning better to their decommissioning of assets offshore and their renewable aspirations. I'm thinking about the South West, South Wales. There might be other clusters. And Scotland, of course, they've got Aberdeen and it's got St Fergus. Their ScotWind is slightly delayed, but it will come. But the timelines will be shuffling around and revising. Of course, there's going to be delays. Every major project has issues to solve. There'll be lessons to be learned. But offshore wind had something similar, didn't it? And that ultimately has proven something of a template for these clusters, I suppose, in that you can find synergies, you can get the overall cost down, perhaps, and you can go for the low-hanging fruit. And now the two are starting to mix together. So you're getting clusters for carbon capture and storage, but also with renewable elements, also with offshore wind servicing, and also for decarbonising who knows what offshore as well. So a whole heap of variables. I don't really know the answer to it. I don't think anybody really
knows the answer
to it, other than let's take the next step. Everybody's talking, it's not just the UK. If we stand still and say, oh, we're not interested in that, you might find that the Dutch or the Germans get some of the ones that you mentioned, Australia and elsewhere. So we're not in isolation. And of course, that might also opportunities for learning innovation and hopefully cost cutting as well, because it's not going to be cheap. And I feel as though that's been ignored by some of the some of the glossy press releases that we read and the statements. Nobody says, well, who's going to pay for this?
Yeah, it's not related to clusters, but the announcement yesterday in the States for the what it's called, the latest kind of $2 or $3 trillion infrastructure plan, which covers all sorts of things, from roads, bridges, but also has quite a lot in there for EVs and other bits and pieces. I mean, it's interesting as to whether something similar here, because that's very much a government, a much more kind of government interventionist approach, isn't it? Whereas certainly here, the trend in the past has been much more towards a kind of market framework, and then let the market industry spend the money. Provide kind of, in this case, you might look at it and say, well, what industry needs to be able to make those investment decisions is a carbon price or whatever. We're still waiting to see how exactly the carbon market's going to work here. Now we've left the EU, I think May, they've talked about setting that. So will the government kind of put relatively small amounts of money that they've put in now and then look at just setting up frameworks in which private investment comes in, or will there be a shift more towards a kind of more interventionist kind of, as you say, this term industrial strategy that's come back? Will that, it'll be interesting to see how that American approach, if it gets through Congress, I mean, it may never happen, it may end up being smaller, but it was kind of a big ticket. We're going to throw lots of money about this, sod the deficit, sod austerity, this we're going to spend billions, and it was all about
it's all very new deal-y type of stuff, exactly. Isn't it, as so, the last 20 years didn't happen to some extent.
It'd be interesting to see whether that same approach to some extent comes elsewhere as well, or whether it's more kind of setting rules, setting regulations, than letting industry get on with it. I mean, certainly it will be the latter one I would expect. And I suppose in terms of taking these forward, at the moment, it can all sound very good, but it's kind of lack of clarity on those kind of things. I think that's what we'll have to play through over the next year or so, is kind of how does this strategy turn into actual legislation, actual regulations? What is there going to be a carbon price, or what's going to justify people spending the money to store carbon underground rather than just emit it? There's got to be some kind of business, tangible financial penalty for doing that. So how's that going to work? I think though it's going to be those mechanisms more than kind of just throwing more grants at it, I suspect, will matter.
I suppose some of the change would have happened anyway, even if there hadn't been this fancy new world of renewables and clustering. The gas grid would have needed refurbishing anyway. Some of the oil fields and gas fields are coming to the end of life anyway.
Well, the gas grid, they have been. I mean, the National Grid have been going through the gas grid, putting plastic pipes in for the last kind of 10 or 15 years, haven't they? I mean, regardless of, now that means that some of those are probably more suitable for if you did want to put hydrogen into them than they would be elsewhere. But that wasn't done because of hydrogen. That was done because of just refurbishment just going through the gas grid and modernising it, really.
So I suppose that you don't get grants of 70 million plus lightly, and you'd have to put a pretty detailed business case. You don't just get these on the nod, and I haven't had a good look at the business case, but I'm sure there'll all be all kinds of variables. And as I say, then I suppose there will be, say, well, let's see if we can track where this 70 million pounds actually goes. I did see some interesting nuances in looking at some of the partners. I did see that I think CF Fertilizers was putting some match funding in, which I thought was significant. So we're bringing in what you might call sector coupling, for want of a better phrase, where people from the agricultural sectors are starting to get engaged with this. We never used to talk to them as wind farm developers, perhaps the landowners, but they were certainly not main key stakeholders. But they've got I read about a scheme, I think, in Holland where there are 40 stakeholders aligned. My word, that's a project in itself, aligning and keeping them aligned, such a group. So you've got I suppose on the plus side, you've got a very strong stakeholder base. A lot of people saying, yes, bring it on. So if you spend the money, then you'd have to then say, well, look, let's identify where we can use the money effectively. And I suppose if you were Bayes handing out £70 million and more, you'd want to see some pretty quick results. Show me the results. We've given you all this money. What have you done with it? Has it worked? And what do we do next?
Yeah, and I think also that highlights on the challenges, doesn't it, with the kind of clustering idea is... you can't bring it, realistically, you're not going to bring everyone all together at the same time. It's not that you're suddenly going to have no cluster 1 minute and then overnight suddenly a cluster appears because everyone's kind of aligned. I think what I have seen on, like the Humber one, for example, people talk about anchor projects. At some point, there has to be a project that kind of kicks the whole thing off. And in the Humber, I think that it's things like the Salt End, the kind of blue hydrogen linked to offshore wind and not offshore wind linked to offshore carbon capture and storage, and then there's the Triton gas power station and all that kind of stuff. So some project that kind of kicks things off and then justifies the building of some of the other bits and pieces, which then other projects can kind of hook into. But I think that'll be important to see how that plays out in the different locations, again, not just here but also overseas as well. You kind of have to start somewhere, and you probably have to start on something that doesn't require every single possible customer in the regional kind of signing up at the same time. You've got to start with something that has a few players you can get on with, you can get it built, and then you can hang other things off that.
I would agree with that, and I think you might even want to be thinking about your off-taker right from the start as well. Bring that right to the top and say, have you got a big industrial off-taker? So if you were to go down the hydrogen, is there a factory around the corner that would agree to be the first mover in the decarbonisation? Then you don't have to. Then you can de-risk your project, and everybody, the funders, will be happy. I suppose a final point from my point of view, if all this money goes to the clusters, it means it's not going to somebody else, so there is an opportunity cost to it, and so there might be a few grievances out there as well. Well, why hasn't my project, which has been around for a long time, why have we been pushed to the back while this nice shiny new cluster comes from nowhere through the middle and takes all the resources?
Yeah, that's true, but again, I suppose that goes back to somewhere in some darkened office in Whitehall or wherever the relevant department is. It's you're looking at the how bigger impact you can have on emissions and where you can do that most cost effectively and most quickly. So if you target the places where most of those emissions are happening, that's easier, quicker, and probably more cost effective to do than trying to do everything everywhere. So it's again, I think some of it's about kind of looking at where emissions happen, recognizing that's not a homogenous thing, and targeting those key locations. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And also it's kind of, because we're talking about industrial emissions, and it's kind of, we've talked a little bit before about this kind of these hard to decarbonize segments. So they reach the point, I guess, where you can't just keep saying, oh, well, they're hard to decarbonize. It's actually about trying to, okay, let's look at how we can. And they tend to be, these hard to decarbonize segments, they tend to be spread around the place. They tend to be in particular locations, which in some ways gives you an advantage in trying to decarbonize them. In some ways, that's easier than trying to decarbonize everyone's heating system in 30 million households everywhere in the country, all in different types of housing with different levels of insulation, that kind of stuff. So so in some ways you could look at that and say, well, it's probably a quicker and easier route to lower emissions than some of the domestic heating stuff, which has been floating around for years, and there's been various grants, and the most recent one lasted 6 months, and then they've just cancelled it because it wasn't working and all that kind of stuff. That's proven, if you're looking for hard to decarbonize, that kind of segment has proven through experience to be one of the hardest to decarbonize. So actually, maybe some of these hard to decarbonize segments, given the right kind of policy frameworks and a bit of technology innovation, actually are not as hard as you thought in the first place. So it'd be interesting to see how that sort of spins out from these kind of things. The other thing that you kind of touched on in terms of clusters, you mentioned the kind of multimodal. I mean, the other thing about clusters is from a things like other sectors, transport, as we mentioned, ports, shipping, again, because they have to bring bulk quantities of stuff in and out, not all by pipeline, they're usually centres of kind of lots of heavy trucking, rail facilities, shipping, airports. I mean, these kind of things all tend to go together. So the other impact of clusters is the knock-on effect you could potentially then have on other sectors. So we've mentioned things like aviation in the past. Again, aviation is a classic cluster thing, really. An airport is a cluster. I mean, there's lots of things. Planes flying at an airport is only part of the thing. You've got lots of things driving around. You've got lots of heating load, lots of electrical load. Again, all in one place. So it'd be interesting to see how some of the innovations in one place also tie into those kind of things as well. Again, they tend to be in, you tend to build your airport in a kind of nice leafy suburb. It often, there's lots of you may start building it there, but then lots of industry kind of springs up around airports. So there's some interesting linkages, I think, between kind of industrial clusters and things like transport clusters as well, that just kind of naturally come together.
Wow. Well, there's a lot in there. Is there anything that we, I mean, given coming back to the, I think, 170 odd million or whatever the government announced, which is a substantial sum. Many other sectors would have welcomed that. And so it does seem to have gained traction, doesn't it? We're out of the desktop studying. We're into perhaps some of the initial front-end engineering and then also perhaps initial front-runner projects on the basis which try to identify as well. Beyond that, I mean, I don't know if there's any timelines attached to this money or any what there'll be certainly within the business case, there'll be KPIs and all the rest of it that you must deliver before you get the next.
It's a good question. I don't know what the I don't know what the kind of specifics around there'll obviously be specifics around those grants, what they have to do, what they have to show for it, what they have to report back. The good thing about, well, from our point of view, the good thing about public money usually is that the people that take it have to publicise and have to make write reports and make openly available some of the things, the findings they do, which is always quite helpful later on. But timelines is kind of an interesting one. HiNet in the Northwest, which you're familiar with, the last time I looked at that, they were looking at kind of investment decisions by 2023 and kind of actually getting stuff built on the ground more in the kind of 25, 26 timeframe. Are those still what they're looking at, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've not heard any just from major project timelines. I mean, we're already well into 2021 now, so some of the initial couple of years to making some next stage decisions, which is pretty quick. But then again, if you've got a net zero aspiration of 2038, as in Manchester, 2040 in Liverpool, that's the timeline that you've got to keep to. If you start slipping there, you're going to jeopardise other big commitments, and that carries a political cost, especially at the moment. And of course, there is the wider political element as well. We're going to need something after the pandemic, and perhaps these major infrastructure investments might actually be at the right time. They went out of fashion, didn't they? These industrial strategies, they were filed under B for bin for a time, and they were no, don't have them, they're a nightmare. And then they were retrieved from that place, and everybody seems to want them again. So it's a bit cyclical, but the time might be good for me. I don't think some of the political shock that major infrastructure spend will be there now, as it might have been in other more routine times.
Yeah, and I think that's actually that's a key point, is the context, because we often focus on the kind of the technology and the specific kind of details, but I think that the wider context is needing to kind of kickstart growth. So chucking money at things to not just for the sake of it, but to create jobs. And again, it's kind of easier in many ways to do that around clusters, because it kind of concentrates not just the direct jobs you create, but then also the indirect stuff that hangs around that, the people own the coffee shops and the sandwich shops and so on that serve the people that come out of the factories. But also, it's particularly in an area like the UK, there's the transition of jobs, I think, that not enough people have talked about. Thing you could look at what happened with coal and how that was handled, and frankly a bit of a disaster for many people, certainly where I come from, where you're from, that whole what happened to coal industries and people's jobs. I mean, there's still 30, 40 years on, that still rankles with people. That's still a big political issue with people. So I think there's a recognition that if you're going to transition away from natural gas, for example, or away from oil, I think governments have kind of realised they don't want to repeat what they did with coal and just say, right, we don't like oil and gas anymore, so we'll just kind of lay it, we'll shut it down without really a transition plan for what those people go on to and what those communities go on to. So I think it kind of fits also with that, the kind of the narrative and the idea that these are skilled people, they're kind of high value jobs, they pay lots of taxes, there are industrial communities that tend to be whole communities built around particular, like the steel plant or the petrochemical plant or the refinery, whatever, they're big employers. So I think there's also, it also fits in with the whole kind of transition, not just new jobs. I think there's lots of talk about new jobs. I think actually what probably there should be more talk about is transitioning jobs, rather than just, there's no point sacking a load of people over here and creating a bunch of new jobs over here. You might as well, if you can transition people across. So I think that's a big I think that it kind of fits into that aspect as well. And that context, I think, will drive a lot of the policy and the funding. I mean, here in, and I think that's going to be the same everywhere. I mean, that's not just a UK thing. I think that will be the same in any part of the world where that transition is going to happen. In the UK, obviously, there's also a specific issue around kind of regional differences and wealth not being so concentrated in the City of London and spreading it out more towards the regions. And I don't know enough about other countries, but my guess is that other countries actually, that's I imagine that's not something that's specific to the UK. I imagine most countries have, I know a little bit more about the States. Certainly you could look at the States and identify regions which have suffered compared to which others that haven't. I mean, again, without having read the details of the announcement yesterday, a big chunk of it was the States not just kind of following in EVs, but leading in EVs and having domestic manufacturing and all that kind of stuff. And that will be, I'm sure, a big chunk of that is aimed at areas like Detroit and the kind of car, the kind of Rust Belt areas, to revitalize those kind of areas. So yeah, I think those, you can't underestimate the those kind of issues will drive what actually happens.
Yeah, and you see the results. You go to places like Grimsby and Barrow and you can see some of the benefits from that. But I think we've covered that pretty thoroughly today. Listeners, please let us know whether you would like any additional analysis of what we've covered today. But there have been some announcements in recent weeks. We track them very closely, and they're significant announcements as well. £70 million is something that, as I say, many other sectors would welcome. Is there anything else, John, that we've missed out that we should have encompassed on today's announcement?
No, I mean, I think we've covered quite a lot on clusters. I think, as we've sort of summarised at the end, the lots of plans. The what will be interesting over the next year or two is how those plans actually turn into things on the ground. So, but yeah, definitely worth watching. But definitely a trend. I mean, not just one here in the UK. But as I look around things worldwide, I mean, this idea of kind of concentrated geographical areas where projects are going to happen, where lots of things come together, I think as a trend, that's what's one well worth watching and well worth, certainly for investors, for project developers and so on, it's kind of key one to track. So now I think we're good for today. And we'll decide what to talk about next time.
Yeah, thank you very much, listeners. Just a reminder that let us know if you've got some idea that you think you'd like us to chinwag about, or we have opened the microphones as well. If you would like to take part in one of our podcasts, let us know, and we'll try and get something in the diary for that as well. But really, thank you very much indeed from me, and back to you, John.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next time.